Hello. Whenever and whatever we eat causes our blood sugar to rise. Normally it's mopped up by the insulin we produce, but too much food over too many years can lead to system failure. Blood sugar levels remain high and cause damage to the blood vessels. It may be many years before that becomes apparent, but the problem, which is type 2 diabetes, can lead to heart disease and stroke or blindness. Up to 3 million of us have type 2 diabetes, so it is a major public health problem. What can we do about it? Should we be monitoring our blood sugar? There are tests. There are kits designed for home use. Or would regular use of the tape measure give us the answer? Well, 08700 100 444 is the number to call, or you can email your questions to checkup@bbc.co.uk. And our expert today is Dr. Mark van der Pump. He's a diabetes specialist at the Royal Free Hospital here in London. Mark, you don't go anywhere without your tape measure. So how important is that waist measurement?
Well, this is something that I've just started to do, and it's really just been emphasised recently by how important the recognition of a syndrome called the metabolic syndrome is. This is a syndrome where people have recognised that their insulin doesn't work so well and would be compatible with a 94 centimetre or 37 inch waist in a man, or an 80 centimetre, just over 31 inch in a woman. And basically what people are saying is that once your waist circumference goes above that, that you're at risk of getting diabetes in the future.
And sucking in your breath and holding your stomach doesn't count?
No, I mean, I had the depressing event last week of saying, well, at least my waist size at my common store was 36 centimetres, but I wasn't quite measuring or wearing my trousers exactly where one measures the waist, and it should be halfway between the lower end of the ribs and the main spines that come from the pelvis. So it is a very definite, slightly higher than people think.
You'll have put a lot of people on alert now, because 31 inches for a woman, thinking of my own waist measurement, is not particularly high.
Now, I was discussing this with the taxi driver on the Winfolo, and he was basically, I was saying I was doing this, and he said, well, I'm 44 inches, and I was able to tell him how that was actually putting him at quite high risk of getting diabetes and indeed heart disease in the future.
Well, we'll go to our first caller. Pam Irving is in Folkestone and is interested in the question of fat and the role that it plays in the risk of developing diabetes. Pam, what's your concern?
Oh, hello. Well, yes, I've heard a bit about this connection between the waistline and for diabetes. I was tested by my GP for diabetes a few years ago, and I was borderline and was nothing to worry about, so we decided not to bother. I've subsequently packed up smoking, and my waistline has shot up. It's all gone on my waist. Now, what I'd really like to know is the getting rid of the waistline the thing that will reduce the diabetes? Is it a cause, or is it actually a symptom of the thing that causes the diabetes? Is the fat waste in itself a cause?
Excellent question. What's the answer?
Well, the first thing to say is I hesitate when people tell me that tests are borderline, because what that could have indicated is that you were at risk even at some years ago. And so we do know that people, even if they're told their blood sugar is normal, if it's towards the upper end of the normal range, they can progress to diabetes later in life. But you're right, it is the waste that's the key measurement here, and it's thought to be so because it represents the fat we collect inside the tummy. It's not what we collect on the surface of the skin that we imagine. And so if you do scans of people who have got fat tummies, they've got lots of fat in their liver and around their bowel, and that's basically a sign that your insulin isn't working very well and can be one of the indicators that you're going to get diabetes in the future. So you could increase your overall body mass, but as long as you reduce your waist, that's the important thing.
So will reducing the waistline actually help to avert possible diabetes?
Well, at the moment, the studies suggest that it's the association of the waist with the diabetes. What the studies are now trying to show is that actually by reducing the waist, you can prevent the onset of diabetes. And there is reasonable evidence to suggest that that's going to be the case. So that's be my main message to you.
Pam, thank you very much for your question. It does seem a bit unfair when you give up smoking and reduce your risks from smoking. You then put on the extra weight. But it doesn't have to follow, does it?
No, it doesn't. But I think from her long-term health point of view, I think stopping smoking was probably the most important thing. And the next thing to tackle is her waist measurement.
All right, let's go to Dorset now and Patricia Kennedy with a question about diabetes. You've been diagnosed and have had the condition for 3 years.
Yes, nearly 3 years now, yes.
Came as a bit of a shock, did it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
No
right
signs?
Out of the blue. No family history.
So,
nothing.
So how are you managing now?
Well, when you were talking about waist measurement, I know precisely where I stand now. I need to lose the 2 stone the doctor told me, and then I probably won't need to take medication, he said, so it's up to me, isn't it?
Okay, how are you going to tackle that?
Well, not by eating fruit, I understand. This is the conflicting advice I've been given by doctors. One still treats me like a normal human being and says, well, of course you must eat fruit, it's good for you. But some others say, no, fructose is as bad as any other sugar, so you mustn't eat. Although everybody else must eat 5 a day, you must only eat 3.
And this is what confuses us all when we got conflicting reports yes. about these things, because we just take it now as a mantra. You know, 5 portions of fruit and veg a day is an absolute minimum, and yet there is this concern that perhaps too much fruit in this case, if you are diagnosed with diabetes, is perhaps not the right way. Let's try and get a definitive answer on this, Mark.
Well, I think it's still very important to have your 5 portions of fruit and vegetable today. One of the issues is what size is your portion? And clearly a handful of grapes would be a portion, whereas other people might consider a whole bowl of grapes to be a portion. So I think that's important. You're right to some extent that there is still sugar in the fruit that we think and we like as soft, particularly the soft summer fruits tend to be full of sugar. So you're allowed them, it's just limiting the amount and actually focusing more on maybe the harder fruits and vegetables to keep your portion size up. But it's clearly much better eating a portion of fruit than something like a bag of crisps or biscuits. So clearly there are relative other things that are not so good for you. And it's important that you focus on other aspects like eating chicken and fish and keeping your carbohydrate portions as low as possible as well, in terms of looking at your plate and thinking, well, only a quarter of my plate will be the potato component of my meal, and making sure I have at least half the plate as vegetables. But I agree with you, there is conflicting advice, but there is an important point, I think, that one of your doctors was trying to make, is that the softer fruit that we like is sweet and is full of sugar, and that still can cause problems in diabetes.
I mean, there are various myths around diabetes, it seems to me, and one is that you can't eat sugar. Is that an absolute rule, and why should that be so? If you're otherwise eating quite a healthy diet and losing the weight that you need to lose, why not a little bit of sugar?
Well I think that if anyone ever, I never believe any patient of mine will walk out of the clinic and say they never eat sugar. We clearly all do, and there are two strategies. One is that you can incorporate it as part of your main meal, so that the absorption of the sugar is much smoother and as part of another meal rather than just say on its own in the afternoon. And secondly, that actually you could say, well, actually I'll have that cake, but I'll go for a half an hour walk afterwards and actually try and work it off and actually treat it a bit more like that than actually just having a black and white rule that you can't eat sugar.
And what's your view on buying diabetic products?
Well, I usually advise my patients never to buy anything that's got diabetes written on it as a food product. I think you can eat exactly the same as everyone else. It's about the portion size and the amount, not the type of food so much.
Patricia, I hope that's been helpful, and we'll go to another caller, if we may, in Leighton Buzzard. Elaine Goss is waiting to speak to us. Hello there.
Hello.
And another lady with type 2 diabetes. What's
yes.
the particular concern?
I'm trying to control it with diet, and I will say my waist measurement is in that band that they were talking about. Mm. But I have lost 2 stone.
Mm.
During the day, I can keep my blood sugars low and absolutely fine. I go to bed, having read my blood sugars level, wake up in the morning, and they've gone up. I don't know what to do about it. I don't know how I can keep on top of it. And by going up, I mean going over 8.
So you've been advised to keep a check on your
yes.
blood sugars. And
yes.
that's a bit paradoxical. Yes. Presumably you're not one of these who goes down and raids the fridge overnight, are you?
Not as far as I know.
No, but the blood sugar seems to go up.
Yes.
Mark, what's your advice?
Well, there's a very clear explanation for this, and this is another example where we can use the concept of insulin resistance. And so the liver's function is to keep our blood sugars stable when we're not eating. And because your insulin isn't working very well, that's why you've got diabetes, is that the liver is also not recognizing, it's not receiving the signals it normally gets from insulin. And so in effect, it thinks you're starving and need more sugar in your circulation overnight. So you tend to allow sugar to be released from stores within from the liver to allow the sugar, and that's why it rises. So it's a well-recognized phenomenon in type 2 diabetes, and it does sometimes allow us to focus therapies, particularly perhaps with the evening meal or last thing at night. But I think from how you're describing your blood sugars, they sound very good to me, and I think that probably you're within the sort of target range with diet alone that most people would accept as being reasonable.
But I'm actually on metformin.
All right, okay.
Two tablets a day of 850.
Right. Well, what I sometimes tell people to do, if they can tolerate it, is to move their evening tablet to last thing at night rather than with their meal. So some people can take the tablet with a meal or without it, and sometimes take it without a meal. So if you just maybe take a smaller dose before you go to bed, you discuss this with your doctor, but actually you can target the sugars overnight. And metformin has got quite a short life of working, so if you're taking it quite early in the evening,
it may be... I'm taking them 12 hours apart.
Yeah, well, it may be that it's just not working long enough for you overnight, so the effect of the metformin is starting to wear off, say, come in the early hours of the morning. So it might just be worth thinking about either splitting or adding a bit more metformin before you go to bed to really target that fasting blood sugar.
So obviously, from what we've heard, Elaine is using a drug to control this.
Yeah.
At what point do you have to give up trying lifestyle changes when you've been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and have to move on to medication?
Well, we have measures of how well people are doing in terms of particularly their blood tests and other factors. But in terms of the sugar, we have a measurement called the HbA1c, or glycosylated hemoglobin, which looks at your sugar levels over the last 3 months and really sees how well you've been doing. And so we assess people according to their diet and lifestyle and the effect on that particular blood test. And if it's clear that you're doing all you can and yet your test is not improving, it's at that point that we can support you with tablets.
And how many people can control it, if you like, with these lifestyle changes, and how many have to go on to drugs?
Okay, well, that's quite a difficult question to answer, because I think that increasingly, because of all the screening that's going on in primary care for cardiovascular disease and cholesterol, that I think a lot more people are being found a lot earlier in the stage of their disease. And so I think you might say up to 20%, 25% of the population might be controlled on so-called diet alone.
So that's good news.
Well, that is good news, but it's also important to recognise that for them, the sugar problem may not be the biggest problem that they've got. The other issue that we were talking about with this metabolic syndrome is that it's the blood pressure and the cholesterol that's very important as well. And so we really hate the term mild diabetes, because some people think that just because their sugars are controlled on diet alone that actually they're okay. But actually the syndrome we're talking about is much more of a heart attack stroke syndrome, and looks at other risk factors other than just purely sugar alone. So we're trying to move away now from diabetes as being solely a sugar problem.
Thank you very much. We'll go to another caller, Antonia. She's in Weymouth in Dorset. Antonia, question please for our expert today, Mark Vandertramp.
Hello. I'm 65 years old. My blood pressure is fine. My body mass index is fine. I have a healthy vegetarian diet. I keep fit by walking at least an hour a day. There's no family history of diabetes. My waist measurement is 28, but I have type 2 diabetes. Am I just unlucky?
Well, it sounds as though you are unlucky. That seems very unfair, doesn't it? Well, why would that be, Mark?
Well, in terms of the genetics of type 2 diabetes aren't clearly understood, but clearly the way I think of it is that there's a group of people who are slim and whose genes are strong enough that they're going to get diabetes no matter what they do. But clearly some people have not such a genetic tendency, or they're overweight and they might get diabetes much earlier than other people. So I think in your particular case that probably what you've done is put off the diagnosis of diabetes for many years, and actually by having your particular lifestyle you may well have prevented the onset of diabetes much earlier than it might have done. So I think all you've done in the past is fantastic, and you need to keep it going. And I think that the importance is that it's where you are now from now on that you have to keep your sugars controlled. But I don't think you got yourself to blame. I don't think there's any problem here. I think it's just you are unlucky. You've been given the problem. It's probably within your genes, and it was just too tough for you to overcome with your lifestyle.
Are you aware of family members with diabetes?
I've asked around, and nobody has any recollection of it. I wondered if there could be some other cause for blood sugars going high.
Well, that's a very good point, and there are certainly other conditions that can cause blood sugars to go high, but they do tend to be relatively rare, and usually associated with other symptoms as well. So I think that would be something for you to discuss with your family doctor, just to make sure that all the other things have been considered. But I see a lot of people with diabetes in exactly the same situation as you, and it just comes on for no reason, and it's just bad luck.
Well, I am taking atorvastatin, just a mild dose, and I've noticed on the information that comes with it that it can cause increases and decreases in blood sugar, and I'm wondering if that could be a factor.
No, I mean, atorvastatin is one of the group of cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins, which is one of the commonest used drugs in diabetes, and so there's no impact on your blood sugar with that drug.
Okay, thanks for that call. I've got an email which I think is along the same lines from Roy Butterfield, who's saying he's fit, healthy, takes lots of exercise, not overweight, but has been diagnosed with type 2. His question, though, is does he need to cut out fat from his diet, or is it just sugar in order to reduce his blood glucose or blood sugar levels?
Well, I suppose the key would be to reduce fat anyway. That's a given. And I think that it's limiting the amount of sugar as much as possible, and also making your carbohydrate more complex. So it's concentrating on the more slowly absorbed carbohydrates. And this is where the glycemic index has got some popularity.
Well, it certainly has. You hear quite a lot about the GI diet. Is that actually relevant then for people with diabetes, and in fact for everyone?
Well, it certainly is, because it just means that your particular carbohydrate that you're eating is much more slowly absorbed, and so you don't see such a high peak of sugar in the bloodstream after you've eaten. So it's allowing your body to have a much smoother excursion of blood sugars after a particular meal. So all the sort of foods that are recommended within a glycemic index diet would be an advantage.
Quick time check, it's 18 minutes past three. This is Check Up with me, Barbara Myers, and with my expert today, he's a diabetes expert, Dr. Mark Vanderpump. And we've got another caller. We'll go to Raymond. Raymond's in Broadstairs. Hello, Raymond, your question, please.
Hello. I've had diabetes, well, I was diagnosed about 20 years ago in Paris at a public laboratory, which came as a complete surprise to me. When I came back to this country, I went straight on to medication, and that continued until about 2 years ago. Now, just towards the end of that time, I managed to lose a little bit of weight, about half a stone, which I was quite proud of, but I now think that was actually a side effect of the worsening diabetes. So then insulin was added, so I now take a mixture of medication and insulin. And since going on to the insulin, I found that, in fact, I've added that weight back on again, that I'm now a stone and a half heavier than I was at that point.
All right, let's see what Mark's got to say about that, putting weight on whilst on medication. Is that something that you've come across?
Well, there's an important point here is the natural history of type 2 diabetes. And so what you've demonstrated, Raymond, is how you've probably been picked up at a screening test before you had symptoms. You initially could be managed on diet, then tablets have been added in. But after about 15 years, it's thought that at least half the patients with type 2 diabetes will need insulin, either in addition to their tablets or replacing their tablets. So you followed the expected progression that one would see. And one of the problems we have with insulin as a therapeutic tool or as a treatment is that a weight gain is almost an expected happening. And so most people tend to find they gain up to 5 kilograms in the first year after therapy.
Well, no one ever warns you of this.
Well, I would have done. And I think that there may be reasons for this. It may be that you gain muscle, and certainly leading up to that time, you probably would have been passing lots of sugar in the urine, and suddenly you're not doing so anymore. And that sugar's got to go somewhere, and it's usually stored as fat. And so in order to limit that problem, people would be recommending that you use as little as possible, and that you take even more active measures in terms of diet and exercise at that time, so that you try and limit the impact of the weight gain. But unfortunately, it is seen as probably a fairly inevitable consequence of going on insulin.
Raymond makes an interesting point there about perhaps not being well advised. How well advised are people when they're given this diagnosis? Do you think the system really is in place to make sure that everyone understands and knows quite what they can do, as well as what medication they need to take?
I mean, my perception is that there is a lot more knowledge about diabetes in primary care. There's a lot more practice nurses delivering diabetes care. People are being diagnosed earlier. They're being offered treatments earlier. And certainly within the new NICE guidelines and GP targets, as diabetes is one of the key indicators for GPs' practices. And so they're very much focused now on making people as well treated as possible and not just targeting their blood sugar, but targeting their blood pressure and their cholesterol as well.
Because we are talking about a national epidemic, aren't we?
Well, this, I mean, it depends. If you're talking about the number you mentioned, there might be 3 million of us with diabetes, then there's a group that we don't know about yet. And there's also the group of people with, say, the waist circumference being high, with blood pressure and cholesterol being high as well, who are yet an unknown group, who may be up to a quarter of the population. So there's a massive group of people who are out there who have not yet got diabetes, who may be at risk in the future. And that goes back to the sedentary nature of our lives now and our change in diet.
And the symptoms are just not really apparent. You can't tell if you're beginning to get diabetes, can you?
Well, in terms of, I mean, diabetes, when it presents as the CLEAR syndrome, is obviously associated with thirst and passing lots of urine and weight loss sometimes. But what we're talking about is the stage well before you get frank diabetes, where you definitely won't have symptoms. And so that's the importance of screening and picking up people at that stage. It was always said that people who developed diabetes would have had it for about 4 to 7 years before they knew they had it. And that partially explains why a lot of people, patients who are diagnosed, do have complications at the time of their diagnosis. So it's very sad to see someone entering a coronary care unit with a myocardial infarction or a heart attack, and they're told they've got diabetes at that particular point, when you can sort of know that they've probably had it for 5 years leading up to that point, and they presented with the disaster of a heart attack rather than being caught 5 years earlier, when they might have been able to do something about getting the heart attack in the first place.
And so there's another of those myths that you can dispel. When people say, well, you don't die of diabetes, the fact is you die of things that are caused by diabetes, connect with diabetes.
Yes, I mean, I think people have to think of it as a cardiovascular syndrome. And there's this big emphasis now on hitting all the various cardiovascular risk factors. So that's really treating the blood pressure, the cholesterol, adding aspirin, and getting the blood sugars as low as possible. And I mean, there's good evidence now that if you're diagnosed with diabetes, you may be reducing your mortality or your death, your life expectancy by 10 years. And so it is a very important cause of morbidity and mortality. And we haven't even talked about the impact in terms of blindness, nerve damage, and kidney damage, which is also another big impact of diabetes.
I've kept James Clarkson waiting in Birmingham. James, your turn.
Hello.
Hello.
I was diagnosed when I was 55 as type 2 diabetes. I'm in my early 60s now. It is controlled by a mixture of medication and diet. But it came as a tremendous shock, because from my late teens, I cut out sugars, jams, cakes, sweets and biscuits. So I thought it was something I could avoid. But I have been told that there was one sign that I had that wasn't picked up. I have had a major problem with heavy sweating for 30 years. It's been tremendously inconvenient all the time. I tried various medications to control it and nothing works. Mm. Does the doctor know anything about the heavy sweating related to diabetes?
Well, in terms of predicting diabetes, that I'm afraid it doesn't really help us, because I mean, sweating can be a complication of diabetes and there are effects on the nervous system, and it can be a complication of treating diabetes, and it can be a sign of hypoglycemia when you've been overtreated with tablets or insulin. It's important that, as well, in diabetes, that there are other medical conditions that can cause sweating, particularly say with a thyroid. Those would be other issues to describe more generally. In your specific case, I don't think there's any association with the sweating that you've experienced over your life and with the development of diabetes at this time.
Okay, thank you for that. I'd like to just read an email from Nigel at the end here. He's saying that, yes, people try to eat less, but the fact is, to lose weight, you shouldn't certainly crash diet. In fact, you should be eating small amounts every 2.5 hours so the body doesn't think it's being deprived and going into starvation mode. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think 2.5 hours is probably a bit generous. I think that the basic principle is that it's small meals regularly rather than large meals intermittently is the key message. And also make sure you've measured your waist.
Yeah. keep an eye on that waist. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Dr. Mark Vanderpump. And thank you to all of you out there for your calls and your emails, not just today, but over the past 3 months. This is the last in the present series of Checkup. If you want any further information about any of the topics that we've covered, then do call our action line, 0800 100 400. Calls are free and confidential. Or you can go to our Checkup website, that's at bbc.co.uk/radio4, where you can listen to any of our programmes again. And until we're back in August, may I wish you very good health.
Checkup was presented by Barbara Myers, and the producer was Erica Wright. Now, Tom Conti presents the Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Norwood, a charity of which he's been a supporter for over 20 years.
Have you ever wondered how you'd feel if you were told your child had an incurable learning disability? What you'd do next, where you'd turn for help? A shattering experience. In an instant, you realise your child will have a very different life from the one you'd mapped out. Gabriella was 2 when she was diagnosed with Rett syndrome. At the age when children start to blossom, Gabriella wasn't walking, and her command of language was actually getting worse. She was having tantrums, couldn't breathe normally, and her movement was severely limited. Bringing up Gabriella was a full-time occupation and getting more demanding with every passing month. Her family simply couldn't cope. Their local authority put them in touch with Norwood, a charity providing specialist support for people with learning disabilities. Norwood is based in London, but provides a huge range of services for thousands of families from all over the country. Norwood's respite care centre, Buckets and Spades, offers children like Gabriella regular stays from a single night up to a full week. It's a large, friendly, superbly equipped house with round-the-clock professional care. With the staff's support, Gabriella enjoys playing in the local park, gets to visit attractions like the London Eye, and loves shopping, activities her parents found overwhelming to organise themselves. While Gabriella's at Buckets and Spades, they can recharge their batteries, get some uninterrupted sleep, and focus again on their other children. They said Norwood is a lifesaver. We adore Gabriella, but caring for her is incredibly hard work. The break allows us to appreciate her even more when she comes home. Gabriella also attends Norwood's recreational scheme, Unity. Unity's weekly clubs and residential holidays offer the chance to learn new skills and make new friends with activities like canoeing, abseiling and discos. There's no happy ending to Gabriella's story. At 13, she has the ability level of a 2-year-old. She'll become more and more dependent and eventually need full-time care. But her family knows that with Norwood's support, she'll have the best possible quality of life. Norwood's vital work relies heavily on voluntary funding. It offers disabled children like Gabriella the chance to reach the absolute peaks of their potential. And why should they settle for any less?